Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. One of the most neglected corners of state government in the modern era is the one that houses our systems of criminal and juvenile justice. Thanks to chronic underinvestment and increasingly antiquated sentencing laws, North Carolina does precious little to help rehabilitate offenders, even though the vast majority will return to society. Last year, however, our team at NC Policy Watch was lucky enough to add a journalist who possesses a wealth of experience in covering criminal justice and corrections in other states. And over the last several months, Kellen Lyons has produced a steady stream of reports documenting the frequently sorry state of these systems. And recently, Kellen sat down with me to discuss some of what he's found so far, including a crisis that's arisen in our juvenile detention facilities, some questionable changes to the way the state prison system handles inmate mail, and calls for the governor to address big racial disparities and inequities. Kellen Lyons, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kel, since joining NC Policy Watch earlier this year, you've been working hard to shine a light on an important area of state government that's often underreported, the correction system and the people who move in and out of our state prisons and jails, county jails. Any initial overall impressions of North Carolina's system? I know you've covered this issue in other states.
Yeah, one of the things I did when I first came to Policy Watch was I asked the Department of Public Safety to take me on some tours of prisons across the state. And I think I've been to maybe four or five. I've been to Nash, Central, just a couple, not too many, but enough to kind of get a general feel for how things are there relative to Connecticut, where I came from. You know, the biggest takeaway that I have is that the prison system here is just a lot bigger. I mean, there are 30,000 people who are in North Carolina prisons compared to 10,000 people who are in Connecticut prisons. And Connecticut's prison system is unified, meaning that they have no county jails. So that's their pretrial population. That's their whole entire incarcerated population. So 30,000 people is a lot more folks to work with. One thing I've noticed both in terms of going, not only visiting the prison systems, but also talking to folks and reading court cases here, prison sentences here are quite long. Like, they have some pretty seriously long prison sentences in North Carolina. I mean, just like in Connecticut, most of the people who are in North Carolina prisons are eventually going to go home, but there are a significant number of folks who are locked up who are probably going to die in prison. And what that ultimately means is that they're going to get old in prison and cost taxpayers a lot of money. They're going to end up essentially dying behind bars. So that's been something that's been interesting to watch from afar, but also interesting to start reporting on, to play with that idea of how long of a sentence is enough for a violent crime or an unspeakable act that forever changes everyone's life.
I know one of the first stories you worked on, you actually connected with some incarcerated individuals who are working maybe for some changes to the law that maybe could give them a shot at not spending the rest of their life in jail.
Yeah, there are these two guys at Nash Correctional, which happens to be one of the prisons that I visited. They actually wrote a bill that made it before the legislature that would have allowed folks who are serving life without parole sentences to essentially have a shot at relief, essentially have a chance of getting out of prison on supervision before they grow too old, they pass away. I mean, the idea was essentially just to give these guys an opportunity to have something to work toward. The guys who were inside were pitching this as an opportunity to incentivize good behavior. They were saying that it would reduce violence among the incarcerated, violence among incarcerated on staff and prisoners on prisoners. You know, and I wrote that story by corresponding with those two guys who were incarcerated at Nash, talking to them on the phone a couple of different times, reading their bill. That's really been a theme of my reporting at all the places I've worked. I try really hard to center the voices of folks who are directly impacted by these policies. I try very hard to make sure that people whose voices aren't typically heard in newspapers or on radio stations or television get amplified by my own reporting. And so I work hard to try to include those perspectives, not only include those perspectives, but to center those perspectives. And I think a story like that was a good example because I was able to uplift those voices and to essentially try to give them a path to build some awareness about the bill that they were proposing.
And sometimes you can tell stories that nobody else has heard about just by paying attention to committee hearings, right? I mean, there was a story that ran before Christmas in which just some remarkable, disturbing news about our juvenile justice system and sort of the state of affairs there, since we've dramatically increased the number of people in that system as a result of having raised the age at which people can be prosecuted as adults. And tell us about that story.
Yeah, so I started doing some reporting on North Carolina's Raise the Age law at the end of 2022. I wrote about that a lot in Connecticut before I came here. I think Connecticut was the first state in the US to raise the age, which essentially means that 16 and 17 year olds aren't automatically put in the adult criminal justice system. They're dealt with in the juvenile system. And North Carolina was the last state to raise the age in the country. So it's only been 3 years here in North Carolina. It's been, I think, maybe 10 or 12 in Connecticut at this point. So I did a pair of stories about how the juvenile justice system has been impacted. It's grown, the juvenile detention centers have grown by about 63% capacity since Raise the Age came into effect. I was at a committee hearing. I watched a committee hearing that had some pretty extraordinary conversation from this deputy director of this program over at the juvenile justice portion of the Department of Public Safety. And he was saying that employees there only make about $35,400. They have no path to get a raise for the entirety of their career. They just cannot recruit or retain workers at those jobs, at those state juvenile detention centers. So one thing that deputy secretary can control is he can offer bonuses to folks, literally just show up to work. They're offering bonuses to people who just go to work. And his point was, if you're the only person on a shift or in a unit on one of your shifts, like you're not really incentivized to show up to work the next time. Like you just wouldn't come, especially for that little money. That's one of the tools they've had signing bonuses. They've had the show up to work bonus. They've had like, I think, retention bonuses. He says it appears to be working because last month was the first time in which more people were hired than left, which I've been doing this a while. Committee hearings, they're kind of insider baseball. They're not typically the most.
Enlightening.
So when I talk to people who don't work in policy or don't work in journalism about committee hearings, they typically think that I'm just rambling. But this guy's comments were unreal. I mean, they were stunning to me that he was saying that they were literally just giving people bonuses, throwing money at people because they showed up to work for to work their shift. And he also said that he's the deputy secretary. He's a high-ranking government employee, and he has shown up and worked shifts himself at the juvenile detention centers. I mean, it's just a really compelling look at how this staffing shortage has really affected the juvenile detention centers. You know, I got that story by just showing up. I just got that story by watching that committee hearing. I didn't write it the day of because I had something to do on that particular day, but I wrote it later in the week and no one had written about it before then. I think one other news station had written a story, but they had only like done a quick interview beforehand. So I was able to get that just by kind of being present and paying attention, which is, I think, time and time again has shown me that is the importance of local and state journalism, of just kind of being in the room or watching the recordings of these committee hearings, because that's kind of where the day-to-day business of justice and legislating gets done.
We're talking with NC Policy Watch investigative reporter Kellen Lyons about North Carolina's criminal justice and corrections system. Another fascinating story from early December explored an issue probably that a lot of people have never thought about, which is the details of how prison mail works and some big changes that North Carolina's made that some people have some pretty strong concerns about how this has changed. Talk to us about that.
So when I was in Connecticut, I had a pretty large network of incarcerated sources. I was constantly trading jail mail back and forth with folks. So I got pretty used to writing mail to prisons across the state. So I try to do the same thing since I've gotten to North Carolina, and I've had some success with that. But I noticed pretty quickly that I wasn't writing letters directly to the prisons in North Carolina. I was writing letters to a PO box in Maryland. North Carolina is joining many states across the country, and they use a third-party private vendor that screens mail that is sent to the incarcerated. They get the mail, they scan the mail, then they like email a copy to the prison, and then the prison prints the mail and gives it to them. So what incarcerated folks are getting is not the letter that you wrote them, it's a copy of the letter that you wrote them. And I based this story on a report from the Prison Policy Initiative, which was essentially looking at the reasons why they thought that this practice was problematic. So the story was really built on the back of their study, which was a nationwide study. But I went to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety to build on it and ask them for some additional information. And I thought that the stuff I got back was interesting. I was grateful to have the space to wait to publish and not just publish based on the Prison Policy Initiative report. Essentially, what I was able to do was figure out just how much drug infraction charges or violations within the prison system have decreased since the use of text behind. And it was kind of a mixed bag. The data is kind of imperfect, in my opinion, because they were only measuring it based off of infractions for drugs, which there could potentially be better metrics that are out there.
But that's the reason they're doing this, right? The idea is that this is will cut down on drugs being mailed into the prison by not actually get people getting the actual physical letters from their loved ones or acquaintances or friends that somehow will cut down on drug offenses in prison, right?
That's the stated reason. And they also note that they were afraid that folks who were in the mail rooms at the prisons would get contact exposure to fentanyl and other drugs. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we see across the country with law enforcement officers. And there's just very little research indicating that that is a thing. And I got DPS to say on the record that they don't have any record of that ever happening. So that was an interesting nugget within that story. But advocates argue that it essentially puts the burden onto incarcerated folks to pay more for other services offered by the same company. So a lot of folks have told me that text behind scans are not that great. They're not good substitutes for getting the real thing. They regularly screw up the scans. It's not a good copy of the original letter. And so it's kind of taking a lifeline that these folks have to the world. So what do they do? If they have the money, then they will rely on the other things that that company offers, you know, things like app, writing emails, that stuff all costs money too. So it's essentially the ultimate nugget here is there's an argument that this incentivizes profit over the well-being of the incarcerated.
And I was struck just by the simple fact that if a child drew, you know, a drawing to send to their parent in jail, that they wouldn't even actually get that physical drawing, which could obviously have some profound psychological benefits. They in fact would just get some sort of scanned version of it, which obviously not quite the same thing. We're coming to the end of our time with Kellen Lyons, who's an investigative reporter at NC Policy Watch, has been reporting on our criminal justice system and our system of prisons and jails. Right now, there are, as we record this, there are a group of advocates who've been gathering outside the governor's mansion, holding a vigil calling for the governor to use some of his clemency powers to address some of the harsh conditions and overcrowding and the fact that some people are in prison and jail who maybe shouldn't even be there. What's going on there?
So this is the third year in a row that advocates are holding this vigil. They're essentially calling on the governor to use these broad powers that he has to reduce the number of folks who are incarcerated in North Carolina prisons. Now, the governor has convened a task force on racial equity and criminal justice. He has gone out and spoken in support of Black Lives Matter. He's gone out and acknowledged the presence of racial disparities within the incarcerated population and in the criminal justice system. And so these folks at the vigil are calling on him over the course of the month of December for the third year in a row to take some steps to reduce the number of folks who are incarcerated and to address those racial disparities. Now, clemency in North Carolina can mean a couple of things. It can mean commuting a sentence, which means cutting a sentence down when someone's incarcerated who is currently locked up. It can mean issuing a pardon, which would mean essentially giving someone another shot at not having that criminal record, criminal conviction on their record, which could help them with employment, housing, things of that nature. I mean, really what they're doing is they're calling on the North Carolina governor, who is a Democrat, to issue these pardons and this clemency before he leaves office in 2024. Because they want to make sure that this can be done. And then over the weekend, they also called on him to commute the sentences of the 135 people who were on death row in North Carolina, as we saw happen in Oregon.
We should note that right after we recorded this interview, the governor did grant clemency or pardons to 10 individuals, an act the advocate standing vigil welcomed, but also made clear they believe does not go nearly far enough to address their concerns.
Kel, please keep up the good work. It's great to talk to you. We'll do this again real soon.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can check us out online and subscribe for free to some of our state's best news coverage and political commentary at ncpolicywatch.com. You can also listen to all of our interviews and commentaries on Apple Podcasts. For producer Clayton Henkels, Rob Schofield, thanks for joining us. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.